They Might Be Giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And They Might Be Giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now They Might Be Giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one. This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
My name is Renato Mariotti. I'm the host of the On Topic podcast, and you're listening to Mueller, She Wrote.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
So, it is political. You're a communist.
No, Mr. Green. Communism is just a red herring. Like all members of the oldest profession, I'm a capitalist.
Hello, and welcome to Mueller, She Wrote. I'm your host, AG. And today, I'm going to speak with the author of the book, Bots Against Us, The Ongoing Information War Against the United States, with the author, Alan Silberberg. It's a really in-depth interview. He's done so much. He worked with the DNC, looking at the Podesta phishing email. They asked him what he thought about that. He's a pandemic security expert, cybersecurity expert, and he literally wrote the book on bots. There is so much important information in this interview that I couldn't cut it down, so it's going to be the show. But for all the other headlines, check out our sister podcast, The Daily Beans. We have all the relevant news, everything that flew under the radar. I mean, we do cover the COVID updates, the important, you know, what we think are, you know, are important updates from COVID-19. We're going to be talking this episode of Daily Beans comes out Monday morning, Sunday night if you're a patron, and you get it ad free if you're a patron. But we're going to be talking about Sullivan hiring his own lawyer in the Flynn case, the same lawyer who represented Kavanaugh during the confirmation hearings and also represented Hillary in the email thing. We're going to be talking about Pompeo failing to hand over documents to the Democratic lawmakers in the House about firing Linick, the inspector general of the State Department, who was looking into his end run around Congress with the $8 billion the Saudi arms sales. We're going to be talking about the U.S. pulling out of the Open Skies Treaty. We have an interview with security law professor about Trump trying to override governors and, you know, 10A and 1A, the 10th Amendment, First Amendment, and how that impacts it. And also Kelly Loeffler donated $1 million to a Trump super PAC. Likely, I don't know if she's trying to distract us from the fact that she is an insider trader. That sounds weird. We also have some great news about Devin Nunes. He was dealt a blow. OAN's suit against Maddow got dropped. We have a lot of headlines in today's Daily Beans. So check that out. But for today, I wanted to really just focus on this really, really interesting interview. But along with all the stories that I just mentioned, well, there's also a story out this week from Business Insider that roughly half the Twitter accounts pushing to reopen America are bots. And joining me today to discuss his book called Bots Against Us, The Ongoing Information War Against the United States, is author and pandemic and cybersecurity expert Alan Silberberg. Alan, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I figured if I was going to talk about a story that had to do with bots, I might as well bring on the person who wrote a book about it. And
thank you.
I'd like to talk about your book, but first I'd like your top line reaction to the reporting that came out from Business Insider that researchers at Carnegie Mellon suggest that bots are dominating the reopen America debate on Twitter. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I think that the definition of bots is a broad definition, so you kind of have to be a little bit careful there. However, having said that, many of the same actors that were involved in trying to stir up the pot with you know, everything from Black Lives Matter protests to Blue Lives Matter protests to Donald Trump rallies to, you know, it's the same cast and characters and it's the same bots. And so we're seeing Russian involvement, you're seeing Chinese involvement, you're seeing domestic players who are trying to agitate against each other. And there's a huge use of bots. I've seen it on Twitter just recently, massive. We're right back to where we were at the 2016 levels in terms of bot involvement in politics. So
yeah, and as it turns out, this was a sweeping analysis from Carnegie Mellon. They looked at over 200 million tweets discussing COVID since January and found that roughly half of the accounts, including what they refer to as 62% of the 1,000 most influential retweeters, appear to be bots. So I wanted to ask you, how can we recognize a bot? What is a bot? How do we recognize it? And how does that compare to other topics that you just brought up, Blue Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, which are apparently typically 10 to 20% bot activity?
The reason I mentioned those is because it's the same pattern of activity, the same kind of, you know, you have a bot network, you have a controller, a human person who's often also active in that bot network as a retweeter or as an aggregator. And what happens is the bots are basically programmed to find each other and to work with each other. And if someone creates a bot army of 10 million accounts and they all have the same programming, they're going to act the exact same way. Some might have different ones. Like there's like the angry bots. There's the bots who challenge you. There's the bots who insult you. There's the bots who agree with you and make you think you're there on your side. There's the bots that just do nothing but name call and insult people. And then there's a whole other level of bots that are really clearly designed to stir up political dissent and create division amongst Americans.
And a lot of, you know, we've been covering the Russia investigation now for a long time on this podcast. And
you've done some great work.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thanks so much. But we've discovered some ways to telltale signs that something is a bot. A lot of times there's syntax that it kind of gives it away. A lot of times they'll have no picture. Sometimes they like to use dogs a lot. Sometimes they'll have like their Twitter handle will be like Bob with a string of 12 numbers after
it. So there's a whole bunch of, I mean, you just listed off a bunch of good ones, but there's several other telltale signs, very clear ones actually. For example, someone pretending to be an American often will talk about barbecues a lot and how much they love football. But when you look at the pictures they're posting, often they're not from America. They're actually from some other country. Or they're writing in English, but as you said, the syntax is not correct. Or when you look at their numbers, they use commas instead of periods as decimal points. And so that right away kind of tells you that you're dealing with someone not from America. And then there's like a whole other level where basically you can kind of test them a little bit and respond. And if they respond back to you, you can see kind of how they're programmed. So like the ones that will automatically start insulting you, that's what they're actually programmed to do. The ones that are like kind of give you one or two or three word responses, obviously that's all they can do. And then there's humans who are involved with that as well. So that you it's very difficult sometimes to determine, you know, who's controlling who. Like is the bot controlling a human or the human controlling a bot? We look for things that are often, like you said, telltale signs, like an account that's been recently created and is also only followed by other accounts that are recently created or only follows other accounts that are recently created. That's a big one. Yeah. Another big one is an account from 2009 on Twitter that only has, you know, 55 people following it, but they follow like, you know, 3,000 people. and they only supposedly they've been on just lurking on Twitter, but really they've been a bot that's been reused, you know, a few times. And then people delete the you know, oftentimes the accounts that aren't caught and aren't banned and aren't blocked will get reused. So they'll get renamed, they'll get refreshed, and they'll delete the history from them because they think that somehow that means that no one can see it. And but then there's also a pattern of, you know, instantly getting a bunch of likes and instantly getting a bunch of retweets off of some really stupid insult someone else says to you. And then you realize, well, gee, who's retweeting them? Who's liking them? And then you kind of fall into that whole rabbit hole, pardon me, of, you know, just constantly chasing them because there's so many.
Yeah, we were recently, somebody who I follow on Twitter, there's some movement to cancel Tony Stark. Who's the actor who played Tony Stark? Why can't I think of his name? He's got three names.
I don't know.
It's okay. I've less than zero. Oh, Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr.
If this was a test, I failed it.
Yeah, they wanted to cancel Robert Downey Jr. I can't believe I forgot him. I'm in love with him. They're trying to cancel him because of his role in Tropic Thunder, and everyone's like, "What? Like that is the weirdest thing." And so they were looking at who was retweeting this, and they were finding a lot of bot activity. It's just really interesting. And you mentioned like accounts that were just created, or accounts that were created in 2009 that have two followers and follow 3,000 people. I used to do a test. I would oftentimes accidentally engage with a bot, and I still do it from time to time. They're getting more sophisticated, but I would always ask, "What inning we sing 'Take Me Out to the Ball Game'?"
Oh, nice. Yeah, I do things like that as well, and especially when someone says they're like born in America. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because anyone who's born here usually is not going to be putting that in their bio.
Right. Right. Although I now want to. Now I want to.
Well, the big one in 2016 was, you know, I love barbecues. You know, I love football. I'm a fan of, you know, you name it. You name the college football team, right? And there'd be some picture of some white American, you know, blonde hair with their girlfriend, you know, watching a football game. You know, and in reality, they're, you know, late at night, they're also tweeting, you know, retweeting, you know, Russian media.
Yeah. Football and Russian media. I'm really into those.
Exactly. Like it's a wonderful combination. But more seriously, though, there are bots involved in our lives in ways that most of us don't even think about. I mean, if you call the bank, you know, on the phone, you're dealing with a bot, basically. You're dealing with a telephone bot, but you're dealing with a robotic software platform that's designed to handle inquiries and to respond in certain ways. Those are programmed in hopefully positive ways. Hopefully you're getting the information you need and, you know, that they are helpful. However, that same exact technology can be used just as effectively in a negative way. And when it's done by a nation state in a paramilitary attack, especially on a country that has no defenses against it and has never dealt with it before, basically, you're just going to overrun the population, just like a virus. It's exactly like we did. In fact, 10 years ago, when social media was just really getting huge, you know, there was a lot of talk about, could you track a virus or something like a, you know, Ebola spread through social media? And it turns out that actually there are a number of studies that show that social media can be a leading indicator of those types of crises, because all of a sudden you start to hear about doctors rushing to the hospital or nurses doing double shifts or people with the sniffles in Chicago, or, you know, and if you did it in aggregate and you were actually listening, you could kind of get ahead of some of those health kind of movements. And that's also true in politics. That's true in diplomacy. And unfortunately, if those types of tools are used on a populace that's not prepared for it, has never had any training in disinformation or in spotting fake media or propaganda, many countries in Europe and Asia and Africa have gone through decades of this. So they've literally had, you know, they've gone to school and actually had classes like, how do you determine a fake piece of information or not? You know, what's propaganda? What's in here? We don't have anything like that, because for so long there really wasn't anything directed at our, that we could see in an immediate fashion. And now everything is 24/7 and everything is right in front of us, and it's in our hands. It's literally in our hands, because you're holding a phone. And so when someone's on Facebook and they're using it on their phone, the connection there to that message that they're seeing is so visceral. And so if you magnify that by a billion people, that's how you get control of people's minds, is is the use of those types of, you know, knowing that someone is more addicted to their phone when they're on Facebook messaging than they are when they're talking to the IRS. Mm-hmm. You know, the knowing that someone is way more addicted to Twitter when people are responding to their tweets and retweeting them than when nobody's paying attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of, you know, us not being prepared, I mean, I know Ukraine was looking at us in 2016 like, guys, don't you see this? And this is especially true, like you said, in a country that's ill prepared for it. But also, we're a country that is governed by an administration that welcomes it and may well even be funding it. And you know, through organizations like PSYOPs and Black Cube and Joel Zammel and that August 3rd meeting in Trump Tower and all that. So
if not funding it, then certainly willing collaborators and part of it. I mean, I'll get to this later when we talk about my book, but part of what I was talking about in my book really was this sort of this relationship between Russians and Americans who decided to collaborate to steal an election. And that happened on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And that happened in real time in real media and in social media and in emails and WhatsApp chats and everything else, and still happening.
Yeah. And speaking of your book, I wanted to get to that next. I wanted to, first of all, ask you what inspired you to write it. And also, what kind of misinformation, bot traffic misinformation, do you discuss? Do you highlight in your book?
What caused me to write it actually was that I accidentally early 2016 came across, you know, a series of botnets that were supporting Bernie Sanders. They were acting very suspicious, and I had never once on Twitter mentioned Bernie Sanders. I've never supported him. I didn't, but I also never, it wasn't something like I never said anything bad about him. I never mentioned him. And then one day in like February or January of 2016, all these Bernie bots started following me in one day, like hundreds of accounts. and that got my attention. And I started looking at some of these accounts, and these were right away, it was very clear that they were not real, they were fake. I mean, there were just so many fake Bernie bot accounts. And then separately from that, I got called in by someone at the DNC in March of 2016 to review the email that Podesta had received that was the sort of initiated all the DNC hacking.
The Google phishing email?
Yeah, exactly. To see what my impression of it was and sort of what, you know, how we would have reacted if we had gotten that email. And it was a very well-crafted phishing email, but it was also, it had a link in it that was a malicious link. And it was obvious that if anyone had spent, you know, a moment's notice, they would have been like, wait, this is probably not right. But someone who's getting 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 emails a day, and they're the head of a campaign, and it's a Google reset thing saying, hey, reset your Google account. I mean, I don't know. How many of us wouldn't fall for it, I guess, is the question. Even with, you know, proper training. If you're in, depending on the heat of the moment, that's kind of how these things have worked. It's social engineering because they're getting in your head. And they're using psychology to manipulate you, whether they're manipulating millions of people at once or one person at a time. And so the combination of that, of being asked to be involved with that, and then these Bernie bots, I basically just started paying very close attention to what was happening with the Russian involvement. At first, it was just with the social media. And then I started, you know, hearing Trump's speeches and hearing him talk about, you know, his love for Putin and whatever. And then when he made the speech and they asked Russia to hack Hillary's emails, I mean, to me, that was like an act of treason. I mean, I'm using that term in the wrong way, I understand, because we weren't technically in war, although Russia since has said that they attacked us as a military gesture through the GRU, and it was in court, in the U.S. federal court, they admitted that it was a military move, and that's why they shouldn't be held accountable for it when the DNC sued them.
Mm, yeah, and Judge Sullivan, of course, asked the prosecutors in the Michael Flynn case, And this isn't, I'm not talking about what Trump said, but yes, but then also, I mean, it's been, the treason word's been brought up a few times.
Yeah, and but I mean, when I said it then, it was more like out of anger, and I had worked in the Bill Clinton White House. I was young and fortunate enough to get a job, you know, when he was president. And I actually served under a real president, and I worked with real professionals, and it was an incredible experience in my life. And everyone I know who was part of that alumni and who's part of the Clinton team, I think would say the same thing. Even with all the lawsuits and all the craziness that went on, you know, the business of the government and the business of the country was handled in an ethical way.
Yeah,
and nobody. You know, there weren't 100,000 people dying. I think that when Trump begged Russia to hack Hillary's emails, to me, it was like, wow, this guy's like a Manchurian puppet, you know? And I kept struggling for the term for it, to find it, you know, the Manchurian Russian candidate. Like, what was the right way to describe it? And then May of 2016, right before... the conventions happened, and it was right around the time that Trump was sort of declaring himself the unofficial nominee. All these Bernie bots that had been following me since January, all of a sudden in one day flipped to Trump bots. Mm. And I was traveling and I saw it happening on my mobile phone, but I couldn't like sit at my computer and do screenshots, unfortunately. So I at that one moment when I could have like actually been like, hey, look, boom, you know, I hundreds and hundreds of accounts switched in one day.
Yeah. And in 2016, I was a Bernie supporter, and all the hashtags like Dem Exit and
that was all Russian.
Crooked DNC and all the people.
Exit, all those efforts. The guy who was behind the Cal Exit platform actually lived in Russia. I mean, you can't get more direct than that.
Yeah. And here we are in California thinking, man, that is a really good idea. And it plays on our desires to not be part of this Republican establishment. But then they turn the tables on you.
It was never a good idea, because it was all about dividing us.
Oh, you know what I mean? It's appealing to the good nature of actual Democrats in California.
Because it's propaganda and it's stuff that we've never been exposed to in any kind of real way before. We've heard about it, and we've seen on the news growing up, you'd see all of these other totalitarian countries that were using propagandistic platforms to control their countries.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were always like, oh, that'll never happen here because of our laws and because we're open society and our, you know, freedom of press. And now we have the press under assault. We have a government, at least a leader in the government, who is willing to subvert himself to the demands of a foreign leader.
Yeah. Well.
And I'm trying to say that nicely. I mean, I really believe there's a much stronger connection. I wrote about this in my book. One of the things that really, really, truly bothered me when I started paying attention to all this in 2016 was we started seeing a parallel communication between the Russian, both the Kremlin itself, official Kremlin media outlets, and groups like RT and Sputnik and some of their kind of like accolades around the world, that was timed almost precisely with what was coming out of the Trump campaign in 2016. So, for example, Donald Trump would make a tweet about something, and 5 seconds later, the Kremlin would retweet it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or the other way around, where the Trump people would actually be taking messaging from the Russians, and then within seconds, it would be repeated and amplified on their end. Mm-hmm. And this happened daily throughout the campaign, on hundreds and hundreds of issues. And it's, to me, it was very clear that what was happening was the Trump campaign was being controlled by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote my book, I actually had an agent, I do not want to mention him, he's a very nice guy, who is one of the top agents in New York City, and he literally was unable to get my book sold. And the reason was because he says, oh, you know, there's more famous people who have stories, or, and it wasn't him saying, this is what the publishing houses were saying. Some of them are saying that, that who cares about the opinion of one cybersecurity expert? You know, they were waiting for the Mueller report to come out, so no one really wanted to kind of like make any moves. And then when it became clear that Mueller was being forced out, and then his, the work that he had farmed out to other agencies might also have been canned, I decided to self-publish the book because I felt that it was extremely important for America to understand what is still going on today. And if you look at this coronavirus situation and the deaths is so heartbreaking. But the lies and the manipulation that we are now going through as a country is almost identical to the lies and manipulation that we went through in 2016, except now the virus is the target du jour.
Yeah, and by a lot is what it seems. And I have to say, I think that you and I can probably share a feeling of vindication when the Mueller report dropped. Mine was volume two, yours was volume one.
Both.
You know what I mean.
For sure.
Because you had just spent all this time writing a book that nobody wanted to buy about bots and cybersecurity and troll farms. And then here is this 250-page volume of a Mueller report, which is just a tiny little tip of the iceberg, by the way, that outlines pretty much everything that you were saying for the past year. And so.
Yeah. And also, I refer people often to the U.S. Intelligence Community report that was issued in January 7th of 2017. So
the
while
ICA,
Obama
yeah.
was still, yeah, while Obama was still president, these all 17 intelligence agencies came together under one report, and they issued a stunning, I think it was a 17-page report. And it was,
I don't know, Alan. I'm not sure though, because you know the CIA said they had a moderate degree of certainty, and the FBI and the NSA said they had a high degree of certainty.
No, that was in October of 2016, but in January of 2017, it was actually, I believe, the first time in history that or modern history that our intelligence agencies have issued such a report. Uh-huh. And I point people to that because that was the pre-Mueller report. And that was the thing that was like very technical. They didn't really name names so much, but they definitely said, here is what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, something that hurt a lot was the October 2016 headline from the New York Times. That there was no, the FBI has found no problem with Russia. But
they have blood on their hands now with Trump and the 100,000 deaths. It's the same. I mean,
yeah. And now we're waiting for the counterintelligence volume, part five of the CISI, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report.
Which, of course, Barr just got, jammed up. So I think,
yeah.
Burr.
Yeah.
And I think obviously there's some effort to try to muffle that report, but my mm-hmm. guess is it's going to find its way to the light of day just because of it's bipartisan, and ultimately someone's going to leak it if it's not.
It'll come out. Mark Warner will release it, just like Dianne Feinstein released diffusion GPS transcripts against the wishes of.
Exactly. I think that the problem right now is that right now we still have Fox News, which is serving as the main propaganda network in America, and 24 hours a day is brainwashing a good portion of this country. They're literally being brainwashed. They're being led to believe that a virus that can kill you simply by walking outside is not dangerous. And, and to that I say, well, if you've ever talked to someone who's had this disease, this virus, you're going to hear a completely different story. And I think that the divisions that are being caused here, if you look at Brexit is a wonderful example because it happened at the same time. It was the same players, the same exact style bot network, the same type of divisionary language and rhetoric. Now Britain is floating all by itself. They basically have no hope of recovering their economy. They're going to have years and years and years of pain. And for what? Because Putin thought that this was a great idea to split UK from the EU and also at the same time to break the United States. And it seems like with Trump as president, we have the second happening also.
Yeah. Putin can be nothing but happy with what's happening
And so they're using the this virus to stir up division. These protests that are out there, these fake protests, these protests that are they're not even protests. They're rallies disguised as protests. Uh-huh. And I did a whole thing on Twitter 2 years ago that got something like a million impressions. Was I basically wrote a short, you know, thread, including multiple live links showing how Trump pays for crowds to come to his rallies, mm-hmm. and buses people in. And then there's a whole side business of they give him $100, and then if they sell some extra, you know, red hats, they make more money. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you that the same people who were being bussed into these rallies 8 months ago are being given giant American flags and, you know, are being paid to show up in Michigan and in California and other places. And in California, we have 40 million people, and you got maybe, what, 500 people protesting, but they get a lot of media attention because there's some right-wing media agitators who want to see a revolution. They're trying to foment a revolution, and they think that something like this coronavirus and the rules and people having to wear masks and not have, you know, keep a distance and all of this, somehow that invades their right to you know, I don't know what have a cheeseburger while they're getting a haircut at the same time.
I don't know.
I mean,
but it's gonna keep going as we wait for a vaccine. I know I saw a report that over 70% of Republicans who watch Fox News believe that the vaccine is a vehicle that Bezos and Bill Gates came up with to inject tracking chips into you.
If that's the case, then, maybe they should just stop using their phones.
That's what I said. The best part is they're tweeting this from their iPhone. But okay. But Steve Jobs is totally safe. Or Tim Apple. Excuse me.
I think that the reality right now is that we're being subjected to a controlling, you know, Trump is trying to control the government as much as possible. They've destroyed the EPA. They've gutted the rules of EPA. They've gutted the Clean Air Act. They've gutted the Clean Water Act. And now under the guise of this COVID pandemic, they're gutting all these industrial rules that mm-hmm. have guided America for decades.
And OSHA.
Workers safe. Yeah.
Well, they're going after Social Security.
And so in a way, I don't know how much you know about Russian history, but when the Soviet Union fell apart and, you know, there was a few years where there was complete chaos. And basically that's how these modern day oligarchs became oligarchs. They were KGB thugs. And they basically took the division and the economic problems, and they forced companies to sell to them on pennies at the dollar, or they would just steal companies outright. And then that's how they became these rich billionaire oligarchs. They're still KGB thugs. They're just billionaire oligarchs. And I think what Trump is trying to do here is replicate that. And if you look at what's happening with how many people are unemployed, 40 million people are unemployed now, you know, and all these businesses are filing for bankruptcy or going out of business. They're trying to close the post office. Now, why is that? Is that because of mail-in ballots? That's one thing, because you can't really argue about mail-in ballots. But the real estate portfolio of the U.S. Postal Service is gigantic. It's prominent, you know, real estate in every major city, every small city in America. Mm-hmm. And so if they were somehow able to privatize that, what do you think that would be about? That would be one giant land grab. And so I think
it would look like the prisons. It would look
like. Yes, exactly. So I think we have to be very careful here, because we're looking at a parallel. And nobody in our media right now is willing to address that, because nobody wants to call out the Russian puppet for being a Russian puppet.
Yeah, we do. And you do. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And I appreciate all your work. I mean, you've been phenomenal at covering all this. And I think and helping to elucidate the information.
I hope we've helped a little. I hope people will check out your book. It's called Bots Against Us. You're a pandemic cybersecurity expert, Alan Silberberg. Thank you for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it. All right, everybody, that is our show for this week, our penultimate show. Please join us next week for the final episode of Mueller, She Wrote. And everyone, please subscribe to the Daily Beans, where we will continue to bring all the Mueller news to you. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And we look forward to seeing you over on that feed. So please take care of yourselves and take care of each other. Don't miss the final episode of Mueller, She Wrote next Sunday. I've been your host, AG, and this is Mueller, She Wrote. Mueller, She Wrote is executive produced and directed by AG and Jordan Coburn, with engineering and editing by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Industries. Our marketing manager, production and social media direction is by Amanda Reeder. Fact-checking and research by AG, Jordan Coburn, and Amanda Reeder, and our knowledgeable listeners. Our web design and branding are by Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios, and our website is MuellerSheWrote.com.
Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, the most wildly entertaining adult beverage-themed podcast in the history of the medium. That's right, the boozy best of the best, baby. And we have the cool celebrity promos to prove it. Check this out.
Hi, I'm Allison Janney, and you're here with me on What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. And that's my sexy voice. Boom.
Boom is right, Academy Award winner Allison Janney. As you can see, celebrities just love this show. How cool is that?
Hey, this is Scottie Pippen, and you're listening to The Dan Dunn Show. And wait, hold on. The name of the show is what?
All right, sure. Scottie Pippen momentarily forgot the show's name, but there's a first time for everything.
Hey, everyone. This is Scoot McNairy. I'm here with Dan Dunn on What Are You Drinking? What's he calling again?
Fine, twice. But famous people really do love this show.
Hi, this is Will Forte, and you're, for some reason, listening to What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn.
Now, what do you mean, for some reason, Will Forte? What's going on?
Hi, this is Kurt Russell. Listen, I escaped from New York, but I couldn't get the hell out of Dan Dunn's happy hour. Please, send help.
Send help? Oh, come on, Kurt Russell. Can somebody out there please help me?
I'm Dita Von Teese, and you're listening to What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn.
Let me try one more time. Come on. Is that right?
What we're drinking? It's amazing. It's amazing.
Right, is it right?
Ah, that's better. So be like Dita Von Teese, friends, and listen to What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, available wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.